Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome, welcome, welcome everyone to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining us a little later tonight will be my good friend and colleague, an American thinker, and a great White Sox fan, Rich Baer, political correspondent of American Thinker. And we're going to talk about the presidential election. In the meantime, I've got with me in the second chair tonight that wild, that wonderful, that wacky, that winsome House Stewart. Oh, hi, how are you doing, Fausta?
Doing very well. Thanks, Rick. How's it going?
It's tax day tomorrow, and of course, nobody's in a good mood. So I'm in a lousy mood. So don't cross me.
How dare you?
Huh? Yeah, don't cross me. Okay.
Nothing like tax day. It's so warm with cheer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Fausta, this past week we witnessed quite the spectacle, something rare in American history. A president, did he set a record for apologies? At the at the summit of the Americas, just an incredible display of, first of all, those things are always hate fests, those hemispheric meetings are always hate fests against the United States, so we shouldn't be surprised at that. But to have a president agreeing with these communists and these radical leftists and these Bolivarians, and it you're right. We were such a beastly power to the Latin America in the last 50 years or so, but we're changed now because I'm president. And we don't do that kind of thing anymore. Well. Lovely. For impressions, Fausta, what do you make of it?
Well, that was the tone that Obama brought to the occasion, which is not a first. I mean, he's been known to apologize to one and all for anything that America has. Of course, bringing up Selma, Alabama, and things like that, forgetting to mention that the reason Selma, Alabama carried consequences because there was a sea change in American culture, and it was the Americans who brought it through. But, like, for instance, on I believe it was Saturday, Rafael Correa, who is president of Ecuador, which is rated at the bottom of international rankings in human rights and freedom of the press and things like that, was giving a 12-minute speech addressing how Ecuador and Latin America are basically paragons of freedom and human rights and putting down the United States. So Obama's response was, I always enjoy the history lessons that I receive when I'm here.
Yeah, right.
I mean, for crying out loud. Yes, and then he went on to say that I am the first one to acknowledge that America's application to concern around human rights has not always been consistent. Please.
Jeez. Well, the big news that came out of the summit, though, was actually made a little bit before them. Last month, President Obama issued an executive order placing 7 Venezuelan officials under sanction. And, you know, it was they were mild sanctions. They weren't anything earth shattering. And Maduro, President Maduro of Venezuela, lost his head and went screaming on about American imperialism. Well, evidently the White House took this to heart because toward the end of last week, Ben Rhodes, the president's former speechwriter, campaign speechwriter, now foreign policy expert, said that, oh, well, that's just the way we do executive orders. It's just pro forma. It doesn't mean anything when we say that Venezuela was an urgent threat to national security and the foreign policy of the United States.
Oh, for crying.
A pro forma? That's what he said, pro forma? Anyway, so during an interview over the weekend at the summit, President Obama said, yeah, Venezuela's not a threat to us. So in the space of 30 days, he overturned his own executive order about the threat from Venezuela. I mean, it's just, I don't think there's anything parallel I can think of in the history of American diplomacy, except maybe we're drawing a red line in Syria for weapons of mass destruction. And then, oops, what red line? Did I say that?
And
incredible.
Venezuela, by the way, is big pals with Iran. Years ago, when Hugo Chavez was alive, he ceded what used to be a shipyard in Margarita Island, which is on the coast of the Caribbean. And he ceded that island that former shipyard to Iran. It turns out that particular plot of land is within shooting range of the Panama Canal easily. And with a little help, it's also within range of Central America, Mexico, the Caribbean, and all of the Gulf states. Venezuela had been running direct flights to Iran for several years, which came back loaded with money and were sent there loaded with drugs. Venezuela is a leading port of departure for drugs heading to Europe by way of Africa. And we're talking expansionism from Iran into Latin America with the help of Venezuela, which, by the way, has issued reportedly official passports to Iranians so they can travel anywhere they want without it being known that they're Iranians. So we're talking a lot of joint work between Iran and Venezuela, but, you know, we're talking about Obama, who back when he was running the first time was saying that, well, you know, Iran is a tiny country that presents no threat to the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, Rick, it is, it's like living in a different dimension.
Yeah. Of course, Venezuela also, and I don't know if this has been confirmed necessarily. I don't think it's been, I know it's not been confirmed in the press, but the CIA, I know, suspected Venezuela of facilitating the building of Hezbollah base training bases in Venezuela.
Yes,
at least
that
one.
That has been confirmed, yes.
It has been confirmed, okay. Because I know that was leaked. It was either Eli Lake or Josh Rogan, a foreign policy magazine, reported that a couple of years ago, I recall. And but that's serious stuff. I mean, so you want to put Venezuela in Iran's orbit, as well as now apparently Greece and a few other misogynistic countries. Anyway, I don't see where Obama could possibly recover his standing in Latin America after what happened at that summit. Do you?
Well, it depends. There is a guy named Leon Krause, who is he's a son of a very well-known Mexican historian. He had a very interesting article today, which is essentially the opposite of my opinion, but what Krause said in his article is that Obama's and reading the title, Obama's Castro handshake returns U.S. leadership to Latin America. The president deftly navigated the treacherous waters at the Panama Summit, but challenges remain. And basically, what he's saying is that what Obama had done by, and these are my words, essentially letting Raul Castro run a triumph on this particular summit was that the United States is not going to be giving Cuba the excuse of the embargo, and that the United States is basically not going to put itself, to show itself as a, how can I put it, an antagonist constantly, so that Cuba will not have that as a basically a leg to stand on in its opposition to the United States and as a propaganda tool. However, León, which is a guy that I like and admire, and I met him actually at the 2008 Republican National Convention, forgets that Cuba has been excellent at one thing, I mean, other than oppressing its people, and that is propaganda. So yeah. While Obama was shaking hands with Fidel, the dissidents that were in Panama had been attacked that very same afternoon. The dissidents were attacked by government operatives, Cuban government operatives, and they were subject to sabotage in their reunions. They had to hide in the ballroom of the hotel they were staying. And they were arrested they were detained by Panamanian authorities while Raul Castro and his diplomats had given them, their operatives, diplomatic immunity, so they got away scot-free.
Jeez.
As we speak, by the way, one of the men who was actually punched out, who's known by Antunes, he's one of the main dissidents, best-known dissidents, and this is a person, I have not met him, but I admire his work. He is being besieged at his house because the government called for an act of repudiation, which is people showing up at their private residences of the dissidents, and he's being attacked as we speak right now.
Yeah. Well, of course, we took Cuba off the terror list, or we're going to take Cuba off the terror list, and get absolutely nothing in return. I mean, you know, this guy, wouldn't you love to negotiate a used car sale with President Obama? I mean, give away the store, you know, just to get you to buy. I'd buy a used car from that man any day of the week. He might be the worst negotiator on the planet. I mean, you know, even some of these, even dictators are better than him. Anyway, so there's nothing much we can do there. Let's bring on our guest for this evening, my good friend and colleague at the American Thinker, the political correspondent there, and a great White Sox fan, Rich Bear. Rich, how's it going?
Doing just fine. How are you guys doing?
Can you
hear me?
We were talking about, yes, I can hear you fine. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Okay. We were talking about earlier, it's tax day tomorrow, so a lot of people in a bad mood today. I know I am.
You got to get an extension and put it off for 6 months. So.
I did, but I had my estimated my quarterlies due today, too, so that was bad.
Yep.
My wallet feels 10 pounds lighter. Amazing. So, yes, anyway, we're going to talk about the presidential nomination, the race for the nominations in the Democratic and Republican parties. We had some interesting announcements over the weekend. Hillary Clinton stuck her head out her front door and said, "I'm running." And then closed the door. Didn't answer any questions or anything. Just said, "I'm running. Catch me if you can." And so she renounced. But then this surprised me that Marco Rubio's announcement on Monday just totally blew Hillary off the front pages. And, of course, that could be because Nate Silver's blog, 538, declares him the first serious contender for the nomination. Let's start with Rubio because he's a Republican and we all love him. God help us. But we all love him. Let's start with Rubio. Is he a serious contender for the presidency?
Yeah, I actually thought the 538 analysis Nate Silver site was really quite good. I think they, by the way, are just getting better and better. And they're also simply believable and objective at this point. They are one of the very few places you can read anything political these days, on from Real Clear Politics to any website, where you don't know within two sentences what side someone's on and what the spin's going to be. So, I mean, his stuff is numerical. It's data-driven. They talk about it. I mean, they understand politics. But they don't let their personal preference, and I think probably most of the people working for Nate Silver, including Nate Silver, are progressives. But I think they give it to you straight. So I don't see what they've written about Rubio as an attempt to push him because they think he'd be easier to beat. Just like Bill Clinton made a similar comment apparently in the last week or two, saying that he thought the toughest Republicans for Hillary would be Rubio and then Bush, suggesting again that if you take a state like Florida, which is always one of the key toss-up states, it's been close really in six consecutive presidential elections, no one winning by more than 5%, and each party winning three times. And the last time it was the closest state of any, with just a 0.7% margin. If Republicans nominate a candidate who's Florida-friendly, which means either Rubio or Bush, and you get 29 electoral votes that become tough for the Democrats to win, it means the Republicans get an opportunity to focus on the others they need to do to pull themselves, you know, beyond this supposed blue wall and give themselves a fighting chance. You know, if you have to win an inside straight every time and win, you know, six or seven states that are all kind of tricky or all toss-ups or lean the other way, that's tough. But if you get Florida out of the way, there are many more options to get to victory. And I think, you know, Clinton's smart enough to understand that. And I think it'll be a fiercely competitive state. There's been a lot of growth in the Puerto Rican population around Orlando, which tends to vote Democratic. Younger Cubans are not as Republican as they used to be. But all that said, either Bush or Rubio gives the Republicans a couple-point edge in the state compared to any other contender. So that's not something that Silver specifically looked at here. He did a different kind of analysis, which was that the ideal Republican nominee is someone who is perceived as conservative and also electable. So someone who can be accepted by moderates as electable, accepted by conservatives is not necessarily their first choice, but someone they find palatable, not someone they think is just total squish like McCain. So, you know, they make an interesting argument that Rubio, in a sense, is going to wind up competing with Walker, who's making the same argument on electability, youth, you know, track record, and being conservative. Whereas Bush is relying more on, he was a decent governor in Florida, though that term ended about 10 years, almost 10 years ago.
Yes.
So he's a Bush, which detracts from one of the Republican arguments this year that they are the new party, the fresh party, the new faces, the party with vigor, and in general, younger candidates have been winning presidential elections lately over older candidates. The only exception was George W. Bush, I think, was a year older than Gore in 2000, which I hardly think is an exception that anybody yeah. should get too upset about. So I think yeah. Rubio is a strong candidate. The major thing he's, I think he's going to have a problem with is he's not a lot of people's first choice. He's a lot of people's second choice. And he is pretty much everybody's acceptable candidate. But, you know, in primaries, people sometimes vote their passions. It's where you get your chance to get the guy you really want, or at least to make that effort. So Rubio is going to have to not just finish second, he's going to have to get some wins. And that probably means that either Bush or Walker will have to stumble for him to get to the very, very top tier. Right now I'd rate him probably third in the race, but you know, I think Bush has more money. Walker at the moment has probably more kind of excitement and appeal from the conservative base. Cruz had a nice start, but I think he still is going to find kind of a limited upside at this point, given just a lot of things about him.
Right. We'll talk about those other candidates later. I want to stick with Rubio at the moment. You mentioned Florida and the Puerto Ricans, and of course, the Hispanic vote is now going, could be the difference. And by that, I mean this. In 2012, what did Romney got, what, 24% of the 27% of the Hispanic vote? Mm-hmm. If Rubio can get 40 or 45% of the Hispanic vote.
Like George W. Bush did. Yeah, Bush
yes,
got that.
That brings Colorado, Virginia, Iowa, Nevada, mm-hmm. all of them really into play in a way they haven't been since 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And that should be something to be considered. Except the only problem is the first three primaries. Rubio has to survive Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess he's not doing too badly among evangelical Christians. Mm-hmm. His social conservative bona fides are pretty solid. Mm. But it's everything else. It's immigration. You know, you talked to me a year ago, I would have said Rubio was dead in the water.
Yeah,
but
no,
he's,
and I think,
you know, he, go ahead.
Yeah, the good thing is he's had 2 years since that was played out. That was 2013 story. And I think he's back on his feet. He's made amends. He's gone on to the very conservative talk radio programs and, you know, admitted that he's made, you know, sort of made a mistake. At the same point, though, When he runs, and let's assume he's the general election nominee, he can point to the fact that he made an attempt. You know, he tried. You know, because the American people, especially those in the independent, those, you know, small percentage of American voters who are actually swing voters, it's not a big number. People who call themselves independent, most of them tend to lean Republican or lean Democratic. They're not really swing voters. And those potential swing voters tend to like people who are at least able or willing or will make an attempt at compromise. They're not too hardline. They like this delusion of a government where everybody gets along and is respectful, and that's why they're only 3 or 5% of the population, because the other 93 to 95 has sort of figured out by now that's not the way it works. Hey, when you have the power, you steamroller the other side, which why we have Obamacare. But the in any case, the first four states are tricky for him. I mean, Iowa and New Hampshire, I don't think he has a strong base, and he has not been out on the road the way some of the other candidates who are certain to be candidates, whether or not they're already in, have spent time in the last few months already. So he's got a little bit of catch-up to do there. South Carolina is not a natural state for him either. Nevada might, to some extent, be the most interesting because Nevada is 20 to 25% Hispanic. And, you know, most of them don't vote in a Republican primary. Some of them do. But remember, in Nevada, just like in New Mexico, two states that have gone Democratic the last two elections, Republican Hispanic governors have been elected twice. And in Nevada by decisive margins. So there is, you know, crossover potential there, and it's an important thing that he's going to have to prove, which is that he can attract votes not just among Cubans in Florida or New Jersey, you know, which are the two biggest states for Cubans in America, but that he can also win Mexicans and South Americans and Dominicans. And you know, the idea that there's kind of a single monolithic Hispanic vote out there is sort of an absurdity. It's like saying that Orthodox Jews and Reformed Jews vote the same way and think the same way.
Right.
So Rubio, you know, is going to have to step it up some, get Puerto Ricans in Florida and other, and you know, New York and New Jersey during these primaries. We'll see. We don't know that this is not a done deal that one type of Hispanic is going to have broad appeal among Hispanics in general. Now, among Hispanics, the fact that he worked on an immigration bill is probably a plus among those who are not automatically Republican-leaning. So,
yeah.
You know, it depends on the states and whether they're open primaries or not. In Iowa, you can be a Democrat and vote in that first primary. New Hampshire, best I know, is an open primary state as well. The closed states, he's probably going to get less of a boost because you don't have as many registered Republicans among Hispanics.
Yeah, and well, Nevada is a caucus state, so, or at least
mm-hmm.
it has been. I don't know. There was talk of turning it into a primary,
mm-hmm.
But Rand Paul is dead set against that. He's got his father's troops in Nevada, and
right.
Of course, Ron Paul is one of the only contests he won in 2012. Faust, I wanted to bring you in on this because you're an expert on Latin America, the Hispanic politics in America. What's your take on Rubio's relationship with the Hispanic community in America, the various Hispanic communities in America?
I think Rubio can be very effective because I am not trying to trivialize him, but because of personality factors, I mean, he's very engaging, he looks good, he has charm, he speaks well, and he can communicate very well with basically any group. Now, the problem he may have, particularly with the Mexican electorate, would be his stance on amnesty, because, as you know, he changed tracks on that. But he can attest that his parents, you know, like he says, his father was a waiter and his mother a bartender and his mom was a maid. So a lot of people can relate to that. I think, however, like Rich said, anyone who thinks that there is a monolithic Latino electorate is dreaming. I mean, it just isn't. Everybody, there are dozens of different, even ethnic groups among Latinos, and the electorate itself is very different. So, but if anybody has a chance of that, it would be certainly Rubio. Ted Cruz to
yeah.
some extent, but Rubio certainly could.
Yeah, you know, Rich mentioned, I think it was last year, actually, when we were talking about this, that recent Hispanic arrivals, you know, who have become citizens, who are eligible to vote, are much more likely to vote Democratic because they come from countries that have generous welfare programs, and that they would tend to vote Democratic for that reason. Do you find that a compelling argument?
That, unfortunately, is true to a fairly large extent. The problem is that you have two very different kinds of Latinos coming into the country. You have educated people with high income, professionals in the traditional professions, and who have money and assets and so on. And you also have a very large number of uneducated people who are barely literate, either in English or in Spanish, will vote for a handout. And unfortunately, there's a very large number of people like that, even after they become citizens. And currently, Obama's concessions to Central Americans in particular is going to only increase the number of people coming in, because I don't know if you remember, Obama is now paying for one-way airfare of the children of people from El Salvador, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and Honduras to bring in their children. So, they tend to vote for basically entitlement.
Yeah, and nothing you can do about that unless you want to try and convert them at some point, or hope their children become more Republican, because otherwise, as Rich has mentioned several times, you're talking about a permanent Democratic majority.
Well, there is somebody who's doing something about that. Daniel Garza's group, which name totally escapes my mind right now. He was the son of Mexican immigrants, and he was essentially a field worker when he was a child. And his initiative, even when they are more or less per amnesty, his initiative is to show people the value of a work ethic, of the American traditional way of life, you know, improving yourself, an education, working at a job that you can spring off into a better position, and so on, entrepreneurship, personal responsibility, family values, and things like that. So there is somebody who is, and from the Latino community, by the way, who is doing something about it. But it's the kind of thing that this takes a very long time.
Yeah, that is going to be a problem. Rich, let's move on to the star of the show, Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
What did you make of her rollout? Seemed to get a lot of criticism.
I guess Chuck Todd gave her an A, and Peter Beinart is talking about how she's an unabashed progressive now, which I guess is based on the fact of one line in a 2-minute video where she said there are too many powerful people at the top, which I guess must mean her entire donor base. Unlike Obama, who got a fair amount of $5 and $10 contributions in 2008, Hillary got almost all of her money from larger gifts. So, I mean, my own take is the whole thing, including both the 2-minute rollout and this van trip out to Iowa, is appalling. I mean, think about what happened last night. She was filmed in a Chipotle restaurant near Toledo, in Maumee, Ohio. And because it wasn't a scheduled stop to make her relatable, she just had her food and they left. Because the scheduled, relatable new Hillary, who will talk to people and spend time and listen to her concerns, isn't scheduled until tomorrow. So you can't essentially go off script, which means you're a normal human being and you're running for president, and you say hello to people in a restaurant rather than disguise yourself with glasses. So, I mean, in essence, anyone who's taking this seriously and is trying to draw some sort of insight into what the new Hillary is, what you're seeing is what happens when you have about 9,000 top campaign strategists. And these are the people, the Clintons, with the biggest Rolodexes in the history of the world. And everyone is hired. They were either in the foundation or the global initiative or ready for Hillary or lining up to be in ready for Hillary. And they all have some input to provide. Try to think of how many people and how much time must have gone into planning that 2-minute script so they would get gay men and gay women, older woman, black couple with a baby. White entrepreneur, or at least, someone in a small business. You might think that given that 70% of blacks are born out of wedlock, maybe you would have had someone, a kid in a neighborhood in Chicago where his brother, somebody else got shot. Or you'd have a handicapped person on. I mean, somebody who's in need of something, not the people in this commercial, all of whom look like they're doing okay. What do they need from Hillary? She's going to tack on. I mean, she's going to tack on a couple percent to the rate that venture capitalists pay with their carried interest? I mean, what exactly is she going to do to change, the lives of these people in the ad who don't look like they're hurting? None of them look like they're hurting. But there are plenty of people in America who are hurting. So, I mean, if the ad was that she's going to help out, she's going to be a voice for people, these are not the ones who need anything from her. But you don't win elections by showing poor people or crippled people, or mentally retarded people or homeless people or kids in the ghetto, because nobody's particularly interested in voting for a campaign that's about them.
Yeah.
So you gotta go out from the middle, and the spin she decided to put on it was to put perfectly happy people in the ad. And I'm wondering, what is the problem? What do these people need?
Yeah. Well, of course, this is what terrifies Democrats, is that, the spotlight comes on, a director says, action, and Hillary has absolutely nothing to say. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing new, nothing old. That the only thing she has, look at my breasts, I'm a woman. That's about it. who said it? Genitalianism. Who said that? Some Republicans said genitalianism. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But are American women really that stupid? I mean, come on. I'm sure there are going to be a lot of women that do vote for her because she's a woman. But if she's got nothing to say, if she's got no concrete plan to jumpstart the economy, because it's still in near recession levels, might even be in recession by 2016. What is she going to point to in foreign policy? Well, look at how well we did in Libya.
Yeah, I did a million miles, and I shook hands and got pictures taken with a lot of women and children in third world countries. I mean,
and that Russian reset is going great.
Yeah, I mean, Kerry, at least to his credit, has worked hard to negotiate a terrible deal with Iran. But he at least worked at something that arguably is an important thing to be working on. She just went off on an airplane. And fortunately, these flights, at least, she didn't have to, worry about enemy fire, like she did back in Bosnia. So,
yeah.
I mean, and I think she hasn't fully gotten over that yet. But I just think she is, there is going to be so much to aim at her, and I think most people have made up their minds. And people who say that she's going to do very well among women, well, Democrats always do relatively well among women. There's a gender gap. They always do 5 or 10 points better than they do among men. And I think she will do particularly poorly among men. And I don't think she's going to get a big bounce among whites, which is what one article I read, I think it was by Jill Lawrence, might have been in Politico, or I think it was Politico, maybe The Hill, was arguing that Obama did poorly among whites in some states. That's true. He didn't do very well with them in West Virginia or Kentucky or Louisiana. But Obama did very well among whites in Wisconsin. I mean, he overperformed. Gore barely won the state twice. Obama won Wisconsin by 13% in 2008. Wisconsin is not usually 6 or 7 points more Democratic than the country as a whole. And he buried Hillary in the primary in 2008. So she's got to worry that that's a state, even if it's not Scott Walker, that doesn't appear to be all that friendly to her. So is she going to get a big boost among whites? I think there's more threat that she doesn't get the enthusiasm among blacks that Obama got than there is that she's going to turn white voters back. I think when you vote Republican five or six straight elections, as is now occurring or occurred in states like Arkansas and Kentucky and Louisiana, they're not going back. I mean, those states are not going to now become blue dog Democrat again. They have become Republicans, and she's not going to shift that. And, you know, I think her message is going to be populist and progressive where it needs to be, you know, to get some enthusiasm from the left. But it's going to be, like you say, empty. There's just nothing there. She may be a wonk, you know, when she's in Senate testimony on something, but as a candidate, it's all airbrushed. She's has no it's so cautious, this campaign, that the idea that she will say anything not poll-tested that might require her to actually think on her feet as opposed to just spouting what she's memorized because they think it'll work, you're not going to see it. I think she's going to be a poor candidate, and it'll be a close election because the country's fairly split, and in presidential years, Democrats have a little bit of more of a demographic edge than they do in off years. But Nate Silver says she's not running as an incumbent, and she's running for a third term, and it's going to be a 50-50 race. And, you know, a lot will depend on the economic growth rate and Obama's approval level. If his approval level is 49% and the economy's growing 3%, it's probably enough for her to win, similar to Bush winning after Reagan. But if Obama's at 45 or 46%, economic growth is 1% to 2%, that could be enough for her to lose.
Yeah, well, let's look at some pluses for Hillary. We've looked at the minuses. Let's look at some pluses, because there are some pluses. She has vast experience. I mean, she probably is going to downplay her role as first lady, but she was the most active political and policy first lady in American history. There's no doubt about it. She had her fingers in a lot of pies. And she's failed on health care the first time around, but there is also the fact that she, you know, was involved in all sorts of initiatives that Bill eventually got passed once he figured out that he had to turn to the right to do it. She was a senator, middling senator, I guess, so didn't really sponsor anything major. And then, of course, Secretary of State. We can joke about Benghazi and Libya and Iraq, where the president withdrew and called that a success until it's no longer a success. But the fact is that, you know, she does have at least a resume that is very impressive, far more so than any resume of any Republican that's going to be running, including Jeb Bush or Chris Christie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there are a couple things. First of all, she's got universal name recognition, and about half the country seems to like her. About half the country seems not to like her. But that's not bad, because she has no opposition, effectively. She is a lock to be nominated, so she's halfway there. You know, we talked before about, you know, how attractive is Rubio, how attractive is Walker. None of those guys has more than about a 20-25% chance of being nominated. All right? So she's got a 100% chance to be nominated. And if her chances are 50% to get elected, the chances that she's president are much higher than any single Republican at this point. Now, maybe all Republicans together are 50%, but she's 50% herself. Okay. The second is, because she doesn't have opposition, and she's going to raise unlimited amounts of money, probably more than Obama raised in 2012, she's going to have kind of a year and a half to establish essentially the ground operation they want in the 8 or 10 states that determine the election. She will be able to work on crafting her message. She's going to be able to work on trashing any and all Republicans, especially those who look like they're emerging. The one very positive thing about the Republicans having such a wide open field is it's going to be difficult for her to sort of get early negative attacks in on a likely Republican, because there is no likely Republican. Romney sort of emerged when it was clear that his only opposition was going to be Rick Santorum. That race was pretty much decided. It was just a question of when Santorum would run out of money or give up the ghost. And that's about when Obama's team started going after him as, you know, causing people to lose their insurance, and then they died of cancer, and wiping out and hollowing out one town after another, always in Ohio. This is sort of what they did. The Hillary will, I think, not have quite as early kind of an insight into who she's running against. And because she's not the incumbent, she is trying to run really as someone who's following a successful president. That's, I think, important that she's got to communicate that to blacks, so they won't vote for her in the same numbers because they're very proud of Obama. And at the same time that she is sort of stands apart, stands alone. There's a reason she has no opposition, because she is such a, you know, terrific potential president, and so many people know it. And Americans are just waiting for this opportunity to anoint her. So, you know, there is this possibility that because she doesn't have opposition, because she's not going to essentially have that those animal spirits working, she may be kind of like a a team that has a long layoff before the playoffs begin, or you know, they win a playoff series in three games, and their opponent wins it in five games, and they go into the next series, and the team that won in three games had to wait a week. They lose sometimes a little bit of the edge, and the team that won a fifth game in that deciding game, they are fired up, they're motivated, they can't wait to get on to the next series. There is a risk, I think, some risk for Hillary in that, because she's getting, in a sense, you know, a layover of about a year plus before she's going to get tested. I mean, really not till July. I mean, the conventions are early this time, but, I mean, you're talking from now to July, which is 15 months, she's effectively going to be running unopposed.
Yeah,
I don't think that's
so.
You
don't think Martin O'Malley is a serious contender at all? I mean, he won't be money wise, but if Hillary is kind of falls flat the first few months of this campaign, do you see Democrats maybe giving O'Malley a serious look?
No, I don't. I think she won't fall flat because she'll have too much money and too many names in the Democratic establishment committed to her for her to fail. And the other thing is, I mean, I think she would probably, you know, shoot herself in the head before she dropped out of this race, because she concluded that people had no use for her. I mean, I think that's kind of an impossible thing for her to accept. I mean, these are people who are simply not normal. I mean, that's probably to some extent the case with most politicians, and certainly anybody who runs for president has a little bit not normal to them to think they can be or should be president of the United States. And there's a level of ambition and narcissism there, which is not, I think, something that any of us on this call have ever been in a room, you know, where that kind of atmospherics rules. So, but the Clintons are in a separate room, even among all those who are in that intoxication room. I mean, they think Chelsea will be the third Clinton to be president. She's already talking like she wants a career in politics.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if you saw the glam photo spread that they had on her in Elle magazine, the cover, which Iowa Hawk described as the Hoover Dam of photoshopping. That's how great an achievement it was. And then, of course, Tom Lifson told me that I'm never to send him an email anymore with the words Chelsea Clinton and spread in the same line.
Oh, oh, boy. Faust, do you have any questions for Rich before we move on to another candidate?
Well, not so much a question, but a comment. And the Clintons are also in a class apart when it comes to corruption.
Yeah.
The Clinton Foundation and those Haiti contracts after the earthquake in 2010.
Oh, yeah. And the money that went to her brother. And
that's a scandal of itself. And apparently there's something, people are alleging that there is something like $10 billion missing out of those funds.
Yeah,
and,
this is something that there's kind of a sleaze element to them, you know, starting with the way he is with women, but the way they've been with money. This is kind of a new thing. Before the Clintons and Gore, people who had been president or vice president didn't suck up big bucks in the tens of millions level in the years immediately after they left office.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they left penniless with big debts, as Hillary Clinton said. You know, they were a struggling family trying to make do. That one will also – so I'm just trying to think of the ads the Republicans got to be putting together now. I mean, there are so many of them. But the this is kind of a new thing. I mean, Gore and the Clintons between them have a combined net worth of $500 million. This is new. This is, you know, Obama, I'm sure, will probably be the highest paid speaker ever when he goes out there. You know, maybe Tony Robbins gets more, but he'll be in that league. And the $500,000 a speech easy. And he's going to make some huge bucks, too. But the that's not the way Jerry Ford did it. It's not the way Nixon did it. It wasn't Reagan's approach. It wasn't even Jimmy Carter. You know, he stayed in politics, but he didn't try to become a mega millionaire. So that's going to leave an unsavory taste in people's mouth. And the conflicts of interest, I think, are real. And I'm hoping our side does a lot of digging, not all of it now, but, kind of in a sustained drip, drip, drip over the next 15 or 18 months. So the story is always out there because there are so many places, I think, to look to find that kind of corruption.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in Colombia, Hillary apparently changed her mind about when she was Secretary of State about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement after a $150 million donation came to the foundation, to the Bill Clinton Foundation.
Yeah. Nope. Yeah, that kind of thing is probably going to be swept under the rug by the press. They won't broadcast it very much. New York Times did a hit piece on the Clinton Foundation about 3 years ago, and there hasn't been a breath in the press since then. So I don't anticipate much coverage of it. Before we got about 7 minutes left here, wanted to bring Rand Paul up. Very interesting rollout for Rand, in that he was criticized very, very harshly for apparently angering some in the press, some people in the press. I wish more Republicans would get up and leave like he did. I really do. It is insulting to be asked questions like that about abortion or rape or anything else. If they're not going to ask the Democrats the same questions, then Republicans should get up and leave.
Right.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely – I mean, Newt Gingrich, in large part, sort of became a prime contender during the debates in 2007 and 2008 by regularly bashing the press. Now, Gingrich is mega smart. He can talk about as many things as Hillary Clinton, and he's probably more of an idea person. But that was one that Republicans, conservatives, they feel it, that essentially they are alone other than Fox News and a couple talk radio guys, and the rest of the media is out to get them, and they're out to diminish Republicans and so on. So he turned it on Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who is really someone Republicans should be taking advantage of because she's despicable, and she has no, appeal, really, other than maybe to a couple family members. And maybe they know her well enough. That's why they sent her out on the road. But right now, most obstetricians will tell you that a fetus at 22 weeks, has a reasonable chance to survive if delivered. You now have an abortion law that says abortion on demand is good through 26 weeks. That, to me, is something the Republicans should be talking about. Because where do they come up with these proposals for 20 weeks or 22 weeks? It's because that issue exists. And then throwing it back at Debbie Wasserman Schultz, a 7-pound baby, should they have the right to kill it? Barbara Boxer, I don't know if you remember her comment from a couple of years ago. They said, what if there's a partial birth abortion and it fails and the baby, the fetus is born alive? And Barbara Boxer's answer was, the woman should still retain the choice. What does that mean? Club, a mallet, a knife, or a shotgun?
Well, just as an aside here, interesting history behind that 26 weeks date, and that comes from Justice Blackmun, who wrote the original opinion for Roe v. Wade. He's a former a lead attorney at Mayo Clinic, and he wanted to establish a right to privacy between the woman and her doctor and government. He wanted a right to privacy. And at that time, 1973 or 74, 26 weeks was the there were very few fetuses who lived after being born at 26 weeks. Now, as you say, it's 22 weeks, which is what are these women anti-science now? We can, you know, the Republicans could make that claim. Are they anti-medical science?
It's a great way to turn it on its head. For instance, Robert Kennedy's son was out in California calling mandatory vaccination of children nothing short of the Holocaust because they're all going to get autism. This is a guy who says that people should be jailed for opposing climate change. And he is sort of taking the Jenny McCarthy route on autism, but being much more vicious and obnoxious about it because he's a Kennedy. Right? This is an opportunity. Republicans got to pounce on these every chance they see them. And there are so many arrogant, obnoxious people on the left who are so sure of themselves on these issues that it's an opportunity. I want to get a quick thing about Rand Paul. Rand Paul apparently has picked up on the Obama strategy from 2008, which is to pick up every delegate you can in caucus states because that's where he's going to have the greatest appeal. He may not be a natural in primary states, but there are enough states with caucuses and enough delegates that if you know, the kind of people he gets and the kind of passion, you know, his father got and he'll get from those kind of crowds, there are a bunch of different states where they could sort of outperform with delegates, even if they don't necessarily get, you know, big victories in states like New York or California or something like that. He's not to be discounted because I think he's clever. I think he is in his own space. There's nobody competing with him where he is. And he will, in the states that have open primaries, attract voters who will only vote in a Republican primary to vote for him. They wouldn't consider anybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. Last question of the night to you, Rich, is Rand Paul has made a point, I think a very good point, of outreach. He's gone, he addressed the NAACP, he's addressed LULAC, he's gone and actually extended his hand. Now, he's not been received very well, but that's not the point, is it? The last time, 2012, the Republicans all found something else to do the night of the Univision debate. I mean, that's crazy. You know, they won't even show up, you know, for on an Hispanic channel. They're not even trying. But Rand Paul, do you expect him to continue with that, or is he going to drop that
I think he will, particularly in states that have open primaries. You know, a Republican-only primary is not going to do him a heck of a lot of good unless, again, it's just symbolism for the next state, you know, to get that story into the news. But I think he there's no downside for him in doing it. He's not going to compete, you know, in Chris Christie's space or Jeb Bush's space. And he's probably going to get overshadowed by Ted Cruz and Rubio to some extent. And on foreign policy, he's sort of out there alone and not necessarily in a good place because the country is seemingly getting a wake-up call from its, you know, isolationism dream after Obama going to end all our wars and bring everybody home and just redistribute money in the United States and we'll all live happily ever after. But that's not working real well. So Paul, I think without that domestic messaging and the sentencing guidelines for drug abusers and the eavesdropping and visiting minority communities, those are all pluses for him. So.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see how that works out for him. He's certainly going to be an interesting debater, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to thank my my guest tonight, Rich Baer, political correspondent, the American Thinker, a frequent co-host here on Rhino Hour of Power. And, Rich, we'll have you back on again real soon.
Terrific. Okay, good. Nice talk to you guys.
And for my co-host, Fausta Wirtz. Fausta, good job as usual. Want to talk to you sometime soon to get back on the show and probably talk more about Central and South America because things are hopping down there.
And maybe we'll talk about why I think that Univision is the wrong place for Republicans to be turning up.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Okay, thanks, Fausta.
All right, Rick, thank you very much.
So join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.